Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1.
The Thinking Atheist. It's not a person. It's a symbol. An idea.
The population of atheists in this country is going through the roof.
Rejecting faith. Pursuing knowledge. Challenging the sacred.
If I tell the truth, it's because I tell the truth. Not because I put my hand on a book and made a wish.
And working together for a more rational world.
Take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way.
Assume nothing. Question everything. And start thinking. This is the Thinking Atheist Podcast, hosted by Seth Andrews.
I don't know why I've been doing some bonus broadcasts lately. I don't know, the content just seemed to lend itself to extra shows. Hopefully you enjoy having something extra to listen to. When I was at the Florida Freethought event early March, in fact, this was March the 5th, No Illusions was one of the speakers. And of course, he's a buddy. I've had him on the show before, but we sat down. I think we talked for 23 minutes, something like that. And I released the video of our interview, and that video link is in the description box. But as I was watching the interview, kind of reviewing it before I uploaded it, I thought, you know, our podcast listeners might really enjoy this. It really lends itself to audio. So, I mean, this is a short feature, you know, less than a half an hour, but it's something to listen to. And Noah is always funny, and he's always so smart and always compelling. And so anyway, just enjoy it. You can watch the video, that link in the description box, or crank up the audio right here. A special bonus podcast for you. And thanks for listening. No Illusions. We're speaking here today on your birthday.
Yeah, 46 today.
So, I mean, are you having that moment? Are you, like, getting all existential, you know, like?
I don't think so. Everybody keeps telling me I'm supposed to, right? I was supposed to freak out at 30, I was supposed to freak out at 40, and now I'm supposed to freak out every year, but not yet. I have a sneaking suspicion it's going to sneak up and hit me all at once, though.
So, you know, you host a bunch of stuff, but obviously Scathing Atheist, would you call that sort of the beginning of this journey, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that was our first show.
Are you still scathing? I mean...
Absolutely. I'll tell you, you know, it used to be that I was scathing on my behalf. Now I'm scathing on my listeners' behalf. You know, they're the ones that feed it to me because I do this for a living now, like yourself. I'm at home all the time. I don't go to an office. I don't, you know, listen to my religious coworkers anymore. Everybody that I work with is an atheist. Everybody I socialize with generally is an atheist. But I still get the listeners that write into me and tell me about their experiences, and they are the fuel now for the scathing.
Are you still pissed off? I mean, scathing came from somewhere, right? I mean, was that it? Like screw religion kind of thing, or what?
Absolutely. It's less screw religion than screw religion's effect on society, obviously. And I thought I was starting to calm down. I thought I was starting to get over it about 5 years ago, and then they elected Trump. And I found a whole new well of scathing, you know? And I realized that it is at least as dangerous as I was afraid it was when we first started doing this.
Tell me about the book. What's the title?
It's called Outbreak, A Crisis of Faith, How Religion Ruined Our Global Pandemic.
It's funny because I was talking to astrophysicist Dr. Dan Batchelder. We were actually having breakfast this morning at a convention. And I said, you know, I saw this post on the internet, which actually made a lot of sense. You know, when you watch a contagion movie, and at the end, they come up with the antidote, and everybody on the planet takes it, and humanity is rescued. We know that's never going to happen now, right? We know that there will be no, hey, everybody will take the shot, and they will all be inoculated, because the hashtag freedom crowd is probably going to wave their flags and banners and talk microchips and shit. I mean, what's the book focus on specifically?
Well, so the book was written very early on in the pandemic. Over the first 2 or 3 weeks, actually, we sat down, me and my partners, Eli Bosnick and Heath Enright, we looked at what was going on in the news, and we saw ahead to exactly what you're talking about, right? To the fact that there's going to be massive resistance to this, and of course, because the religious right had put their people in power leading up to it, and people were being put into scientific positions based on ideology rather than scientific credentials, they had already made it worse before it happened. And of course, we could see then that they were in the act of making it yet even worse. So in the book, I argue, and again, this was for the first few weeks of the pandemic, that religion made it worse beforehand, during, and will continue to make it worse after, and the after in this instance was after we had a vaccine, which of course turned out to be exactly the case.
Yeah, it's crazy to watch people who have such a blasé attitude about the basic precautions to help protect their fellow human beings, especially among this Christian love crowd. It makes you nuts. You get any feedback from the believers on what you do?
Yeah, here and there. You know, I have still a few religious friends that are hangers-on for a very long time, and I still get... The main feedback I get is that the idea that it's a type of demonization, that I just blame every single problem on religion, that I always find the angle by which that I can blame religion no matter who's really at fault. And I think that just really underestimates the number of problems that religion is the root of.
That's not my Jesus. You know,
yep.
I mean, whenever you go to a literal chapter and verse in the Bible and you're like, well, this is what it says and this is what Jesus said. And they'll just blankly look at you and say, well, that's not my Jesus.
Right, yes. where are you getting your Jesus from?
Like, they are custom fitting, like they're a religion in their own image, you know. And it's an ever-moving goalpost. Like, you deal with this all the time. Like, well, Christianity at its center, at its fundamentals, says this. And they just look at you and go, no, it doesn't. And what do you do with that, right?
Right. Well, you know, I find it really interesting. When I first started doing the podcast, one of the first things we did, we said, you know, we're going to have to read the Bible. I'm going to have to read it cover to cover. I'd never read it before. I just knew what the religious people said was in it, what the atheists said was in it. Figured this is going to really help me out as an atheist to have actually read the Bible. And it did. It was useful. But because so few of the Christians had actually read it, it wasn't particularly useful in terms of figuring out what their mindset was. I find that I learn a lot more from watching their movies than I ever did from reading their Bible, from sharing their entertainment, listening to their music, as you did for so long. You know, you learn a lot more of what the true theology of the person you're dealing with is from the entertainment that they consume than you do from the holy book that they, you know, wear nice and thin so they can read 16 passages over and over again.
You know, I did a speech on this about how if the church can't stay relevant theologically, scientifically, historically, morally, it remains relevant culturally, right? It's the tribe we have, the songs we sing, our jewelry, our t-shirts, our games, the places where our kids connect. You know, it's one of those things where people don't know it, but they know it's true. What's that line about Christianity is like a software license, right? You just scroll to the bottom and click, I agree. You brought up the Christian films. You're still doing god-awful movies.
Oh, yeah. Christian movie every week till the day I die, apparently.
If you had the chance to shake hands with Kevin Sorbo right now, you would probably leap at that opportunity? Like, would it be like meeting God himself?
Man, you know, I'll tell you, the thing is that it's funny because one of these days I am going to have that, you know, I'm going to meet Kevin Sorbo and be like, I've seen all your movies, Kevin. And he's going to go, oh, you're a fan. And I'm like, no, I hate you. I hate everything about you. But no, you know, the honest truth is that there are a couple of people in the Christian movie universe that I would love to meet, and I'd love to shake their hands and talk to them about the work they do. But there are also some people who are so malicious and insidious in the messages they're putting out in the world, Kevin Sorbo among them, that I just feel like if I met him, it would probably be best if he and I did not speak.
You feel that way about David A.R. White?
Absolutely, yeah.
Like they're just doing that. Of course, I'm being facetious. Like, it's not a great admiration. I think it's more like they've been sort of in your zip code and you've seen them in the abstract on screen for so long that like the flesh and blood encounter would be surreal, right?
Absolutely.
So, I mean, who are some of the other, I don't know, are they Z-list Hollywood types? I've seen several people who they seem to have jumped from secular Hollywood to pure flicks. I mean, any names come to mind off the top of your head, or?
Well, if you were a big fan of sitcoms in the 80s, a lot of them get ruined for you, right? Like John Ratzenberger, Cliff from Cheers, he shows up in a ton of them. Harry Anderson from Night Court is in it, was in a bunch of Christian movies. Corbin Burnson is in a lot of them. So, you know, it's... You know, I think for some of these people, it's the same thing as how they get into Christian music, right? They, you know, they couldn't quite make it in secular music. The bar is a little bit lower here. In Christian movies, they're just happy to have somebody that anybody recognizes very often. And so, you know, for some of these people, I'm sure that that's the work they can get. And I really can't begrudge them that.
I mean, that's the cynic in me, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, are they a true believer or are they getting paid?
Right. Right?
Or do they have a gig finally, you know?
So. Right. But there are some movies where the messages are so insidious that I can't be that forgiving. You know, look, if you're participating in homophobia, in anti-trans bigotry, in misogyny, these types of things that are very often central to these messages, I can't forgive it because it's a job, you know?
Melissa Joan Hart, right? I mean,
yeah.
The God's Not Dead films, how many do they have to make before the point is made? You know, like, at some point, God would have to show up and say, by the way, I'm not dead. Like, why would he need a film series to... But, you know, the plots of these are just bizarre. You know, like, Christianity is illegal, so they go into a courtroom, and the charges are never really specified. The vibe is what? It's illegal to be a Christian?
Yeah, so that was God's Not Dead 3, the one with Melissa Joan Hart, where Or was that 2? I think that was 2, actually, now that I think they're all bleeding.
You've seen a lot of them whenever they blur together in your mind.
Yeah, right. The God's Not Dead-averse now is all... You got to watch them chronologically, not in the order they came out. That's the key. No, so that one, you know, she said Jesus at as an example, as an answer to some kid's question in class. She was like, well, what's a historical example of somebody who did this? And she said, well, Jesus Christ, for example, and so-and-so. And they sued her because she said Jesus Christ in the schools. And she goes to court. I mean, and everything in that movie happens except she gets raptured from the witness stand. You know, it's just ridiculous. But it's gotten so much worse. We're now on God's Not Dead 4, which was released in theaters between a Tuesday and a Thursday in like January or something like that, you know, so.
I mean, they make them cheaply, and honestly, people are paying. Somebody's paying. I think the first God's Not Dead rolled in $60 million. And you know, they made it for about $5.
Yeah. No, I actually happen to have those numbers off the top of my head. $2 million budget for a $64 million worldwide gross.
Yeah, I mean, it's commerce. And we see this in Christian music has what we call God or girlfriend songs. It depends on kind of the genre you're listening to, the type of Christian music. But they like to do this crossover thing where they sing about love and beauty. And yeah, it can be Yahweh or Jesus, or it can be your girlfriend kind of thing, you know. And it's this weird thing that Christianity does where you have these sort of hardcore Christianity will soon be illegal films. And then you have these weird, misty Hallmark movie ethereal, God is in the ether, he's a spiritual, I don't know, have you seen any of that shit out there? I mean...
Yeah, you know, it's funny because those all came about after Mel Gibson made Passion of the Christ, right? That movie made $600 million, Hollywood went nuts, they all started buying up or starting their own Christian subsidiaries immediately after. So if you look at the 20 top grossing Christian movies of all time on Box Office Mojo, 10 of 20 of them came out since 2014, 19 of 20 of them came out since 2004, since Passions of the Christ, right? That's when Hollywood really started pumping money into that, and they'd made the most, by and large, the most theologically anodyne movies they possibly could, right? The thing that's not gonna piss off the guy who goes to, you know, the Joel Osteen mega church, non-denominational.
The motivational speaker kind of Christian.
The spiritual but not religious folks. They're always the same. It's always a sick or injured kid, right? A bunch of doctors do a bunch of science and a bunch of religious people do a bunch of prayers and who knows how the kid got better, right? It could have been either of them. And that's the movie.
Yeah, Mel Gibson, you drop his name back in the church, and this was still when I was a believer, right? Churches were bussing congregants out to Passion of the Christ, which is ironic. It's like a rated R, hard R gore fest, you know? And they would hold altar calls at the end of Passion. It was a big religious thing. And of course, then it comes out that he's like, you know, the domestic abuse charges. And he's talking about how the Jews are responsible for all the wars in the world. And he's a horrible human being. And the church just sort of got nervously quiet. Like, it's not even that they came out and spoke out against him. It's just that they were like, oh, shit, like, what are we going to do now?
Right.
You know?
Right. Well, keep in mind, he's Catholic. It's not, they're not used to dealing with some controversy here and there by just ignoring it.
So what are, like, if there, I know you get asked this question, forgive me for asking it again, but if you had to choose one that was the worst of the worst, like the movie I had to sit through that made me want to just rip my own skin off.
Oh, okay, so that would be, it's so funny because there's very little that separates my favorite from my least favorite, right? Because it's basically the same criteria.
Yeah, the one you love to hate and the one you hate.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So I'd say the hardest one to ever watch that we ever did, there was a movie we did called Loving the Bad Man about a woman who was raped and decided against her family's urging not to have an abortion, to have the kid. And it was all about her learning to forgive her rapist and let him be a part of the kid's life. And every message within that movie was poison. There was so much, you can reform your abusive partner, you can, you owe it to your rapist to bring them to Jesus. There was just such despicable messaging that there was no way to have fun with it, right? Like a lot of the movies we do, they're terrible. The messages in them might even be misogynistic or homophobic or terrible in some other way. But they're usually so bad that you can still make jokes about them. That movie was so poisonous, it was just, you know, it was. We could barely even do a review on it on our show.
Yeah, how did you handle it on God Awful Movies? Did you just approach it more like a dissection, like a serious dissection?
So what we did on that one is we brought in some very sensitive friends. We had Tom and Cecil on, actually. It was a disaster.
And there's the 800-pound gorilla in the China shop. It's not even, I don't even know if it's a China shop, if it's GAM, but I mean, I'm sure you guys just eviscerated the film.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we actually did that one live in Chicago on stage. So the audience let us know how far we could go, I think, which was useful.
Is live GAM like Riff Tracks? How do you guys do a live show about Christian films?
It's the same as the show that we normally do, where we just kind of walk the audience through the movie from the beginning to the end and just sort of riff on it along the way, point out the poisonous messages that you get, and just try to make it a good garden for jokes.
Is it a comedy show? You call it a comedy show?
Absolutely, yeah.
Is it true? Did I see a screenshot of Eli Bosnick walking out and he was wearing a diaper? I mean, what the hell is going on at these shows, dude? Like, does he just decide he's going to show up in some new outrageous getup every week, or what?
Pretty much, yeah. So it all started as a gag at our very first live show we did in New York. It was Passion of the Christ, actually, that we did. And Eli said, hey, I got this great idea for a joke. You come out first, and then Heath will come out, and then I'll come out in my underwear. and you'll say, Eli, where the hell are your clothes? And I'll say, well, you said to just wear what I normally wear to record. And so he did that. And I told him, I'm like, Eli, that's hilarious. I can't ask you to do that, but you can offer to do it, I guess. So
you need plausible deniability.
Right, yeah, exactly. Can you sign this paper saying that I never urged you to? So he does that. And of course, he hikes his underwear up into his butt as he does it so that as he walks away, he moons the entire audience. And from that point on, I think he's just felt the need to one-up that over and over again. So
but there's got to be a line. There has to be a point where somebody, like one of your hosts, is like, look, we've heard about this guy. He is not allowed to X or Y or whatever, right?
So we're one of the very few podcasts that has a full-time lawyer on retainer on our staff. Like, we literally have a lawyer that we have to run scripts by and say, hey, is it okay to say this? Or how would I phrase this so it's not directly a threat to a Supreme Court justice? That kind of stuff, you know.
Is the Christian film industry mostly pure flicks these days? They seem to be the most, I hate to use the word slick, because they're not really slick. Mm-hmm. They're slick in the sense that Christians might think it's slick. I don't know. But I mean, are they mostly doing this stuff, or are there other companies right now producing content?
Right. The pure flicks, I think, are probably the most prolific, but there are a ton of different production companies at this point. So you have three tiers, essentially. You have the top tier. This is like Affirm Films and I think Relevant. But these are the ones that are owned by Sony, owned by Disney, owned by the big production companies, right? The Hollywood Big Five or Big Six. It's Big Five now, it's Big Six when they started to buy all these up. And then PureFlix is part of that top tier of independent producers. They put out a ton of stuff. And then there's this lower tier, which is, man, that's bread and butter for me. That's there's a website called ChristianCinema.com, and that's where they put the movies that PureFlix won't even touch, the truly despicably.
Now, is it a satirical site, or are they playing it straight?
No, they are absolutely playing it straight, although when you watch the movies, you do have to ask yourself that question a few times.
We watched a movie, I don't know if I was guesting on your show, but it was When Footmen Tire, What Will Horses Do? Did I remember the title?
If Footmen Tire You, What Will Horses Do? That's my favorite worst movie that I've ever
Is
seen
it?
Right there.
Yeah. With Estes Perkel.
Yes.
Who I think had a weird violence fetish against children, right? Because he's got this film, this apocalyptic film, which was, 80% of him behind a podium. And then the rest of it was, you know, they're ramming sticks through the throat of a child and all this kind of stuff, right?
Yeah.
You think some of the people speaking out against all of these quote-unquote sins secretly fetishize them and fantasize about them? You think this is a repressed expression of something they secretly want? I know this is all just speculation, but...
Obviously, but yeah, when you watch some of their movies, it's hard to believe otherwise, you know, especially Estes Perkel. He worked with a director named Roy Ormond, who was a slasher film director before he found Jesus and realized there was a lot more money in this business. Those two things happened simultaneously. Who knows if one had anything to do with the other. And yeah, like you said, the ketchup budget on that movie was insane. Every scene is just splattered with fake blood. He did three or four movies with Roy Ormond, and they were all like that. They were all just horrifically violent. And for no reason, there's a point where one character has to get killed. I can't remember the name of the movie, but one of his movies is a character has to be killed in an auto accident. So he has him beheaded on a motorcycle, and it's just like, why?
Why would you do it?
Why add a severed head when you don't need a severed in.
You could show a, you know, like a wide shot of a car with smoke.
That's all we needed.
The crushed front end and no body, and they'd get the point, right? I see that reflected in like these hell houses on Halloween. You ever heard about those? You know, you go in and there's a bloody gang shooting, and here's an abortion scene, and here's a suicide scene, and there's blood all over the walls. I mean, it's crazy. You know, it makes Tarantino look like Sesame Street, but they're doing it to try to shock you into accepting Christ, I guess, or warning you about the apocalypse. Before we wrap it up, any good apocalypse films on your radar? I know Nick Cage appeared in, I guess appeared is the word. It was more like watching a man golf than it was watching an actor act. But the Left Behind film, did you go?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I watched that one very early on. I think before we even started again, when God Awful Movies was still a segment on Scathing Atheist, yeah. That one was fun. That was a remake of the trilogy that Kirk Cameron did, 20 years before that. But I think that when it comes to Rapture movies, the classic remains the Thief in the Night trilogy,
yeah,
from the late 60s, early 70s. Those movies that traumatized every Christian my age and older.
Right here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Jack me up.
You know, those movies were so carelessly horrific and such obvious and blatant nightmare fuel for children. I don't think it's been done. I don't think that there's a better exemplar of that genre.
It's one of those things where they freak out about the end of the world, but they're supposed to be looking forward to the end of the world.
Right.
Right. Christ is coming. I mean, the more shit goes down, the more we know we're this close to the greatest place beyond imagination that we will spend all eternity in joy and bliss and music with a family dog and whatever. And yet they spend all of this time losing their shit about the apocalypse. I mean, logically, it makes no sense, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think some of it is, again, the fetishizing that you're talking about, but fetishizing what's going to happen to all those people that didn't listen to him, all of those people that beat him in arguments on Facebook and everything, you know, just that revenge fantasy that they get to live through when they're talking about the rapture. But yeah, then there's also... You know, there's some theologies that say that everybody has to live through the tribulation, and then there's the rapture. Some say the rapture comes before the tribulation. And so I think a lot of the movies, for the sake of storytelling, favor the former.
Yeah, you got to go through the meat grinder. So now you've got the hero and the villain and conflict and all the plot devices that have to take place in a good story. What's that line about the old Tom and Jerry cartoons? Why doesn't Tom ever catch Jerry? And it's because, well, if he did, there would be no story.
Right.
Like, why didn't God kill Satan right off the bat? Well, if you do that, there's There's no story, right? What are you guys doing right now, and what should people look for, and how do they find you? You know, kind of give me a punctuation at the end of this sentence.
Sure, yeah. So you can check out The Scathing Atheist, God Awful Movies, The Skeptocrat, D&D Minus, Citation Needed. We do pretty much all the podcasts.
Jesus Christ, how many podcasts are you involved with?
We're doing 5 now. So our goal is to eventually have you every day of the week, but so far we're leaving one for you, Seth.
Like, some sort of is this Jolt Cola? Is this 5-hour energy? You know, whatever else you're doing to try to keep up with it, or what?
Well, most of it is working with some very talented people. You know, I work with Eli Bosnick and Heath Enright, both very prolific comic thinkers. On Citation Needed, I work with Tom and Cecil from the Cognitive Dissonance podcast. So I've done, I work smart. I surround myself with really brilliant people who work really hard, and then I just kind of like grab onto their coattails and hope I can hold on.
That's a great group, though, you know. And they're the kind of guys with no pretense. You could sit down with them and just be, you know. And they really believe in what they're doing, as do you. And I appreciate that. You know, you're trying to, what's that Ingersoll quote? The more false we destroy, the more room there will be for the true, right? Unfortunately, there's a lot of false out there. And you guys are not afraid to tackle it, even if it means being scathing. So thanks for your work and your friendship. And happy birthday, brother.
Thanks a lot.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter for a complete archive of podcasts and videos, products like mugs and t-shirts featuring The Thinking Atheist logo, links to atheist pages and resources, and details on upcoming free thought events and conventions. Log on to our website, thethinkingatheist.com.